From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern promised today she would never say the name of the accused gunman in last week's mosque attack. She spoke in an emotional address to the country's parliament.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name.
Last Friday's shootings at two mosques in Christchurch killed 50 people and wounded dozens. The accused gunman has dismissed his lawyer and will defend himself in his trial. Earlier, I spoke with the BBC's Phil Mercer in Christchurch, where it was 1:30 in the morning.
We are near the Botanic Gardens, just in the centre of Christchurch on New Zealand's South Island. In front of me is a wall, a small piece of grass, and it stretches for maybe 100 metres, and it is covered with flowers, with cards, with candles, balloons, all in memory of the 50 people who were murdered here in this city on Friday. Another 50 people were injured, some of them very seriously. People have come in their thousands to this place over the course of the last 3 or 4 days, really, to be part of the community, to stand together, shoulder to shoulder, a sense of solidarity, a sense of sadness, a sense of disgust that this sort of atrocity can be perpetrated in a place like this. And by and large, we get the sense that people are coming here really to be part of a nation's grief and also to be part of a nation's healing as well.
And we heard the Prime Minister say she doesn't even want to use the gunman's name. Tell us more about the message that she sent today.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand is Jacinda Ardern. There was a special sitting of Parliament. She opened the session with a prayer or a phrase in Arabic. So that really did set the tone, and a very impassioned address by the Prime Minister. She said the man who's accused of perpetrating this atrocity, he was, in her words, a terrorist, a criminal, and an extremist who simply sought notoriety. And the Prime Minister was saying that this thing that he sought from New Zealand, she wouldn't give him, and she wouldn't even utter his name. And she also made the point that such an atrocity must never be allowed to happen again. And there are various strands to that thought from the Prime Minister. Firstly, there will be an inquiry looking at what the various agencies here, what they could or should have known about this individual, his motivation, and his access to weapons. And with that in mind, the Prime Minister has said previously that New Zealand's gun laws will be reformed. She says it's far too easy for individuals to get hold of military-style semi-automatic weapons. So we don't know the details of these gun law reforms, but by this time next week, we will.
Well, and just the fact that New Zealand is moving so quickly on gun law reforms, as we watch from the United States, it seems like it is being handled there in just the opposite way that these kinds of tragedies are dealt with in this country. Such fast movement on something that is, controversial to change the gun laws like that.
I think New Zealand has in some way looked at neighbouring Australia's experience. In April of 1996, a gunman murdered 35 people at a place called Port Arthur, a former penal colony on the Australian island state of Tasmania. Within about 12 days, the government in Australia brought in very tough new gun law. Semi-automatic weapons were banned. There was a buyback scheme, and people were urged to hand in firearms. And it's estimated that 1 million firearms were destroyed by the authorities following the Port Arthur massacre. That was estimated to be a third of the weapons in the entire country. There was academic research last year that pointed very positively that, in its opinion, the gun laws brought in after the 1996 tragedy at Port Arthur had most definitely prevented more mass shootings in Australia. So I think New Zealand is trying to learn from Australia's experience, and Australia's experience is that bringing in tough new gun laws quickly can have a very positive effect.
That is the BBC's Phil Mercer joining us from Christchurch, New Zealand. Phil, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
To the Midwest now, where historic flooding has come at the worst possible time for farmers, many of whom are dealing with severe crop damage and livestock losses. Joining us now is Bill Teal. He's the president of the Nebraska State Dairy Association. And Bill, how much pain are farmers and ranchers feeling across the state today?
This is pretty devastating. We've been dealing with the flood here for several days now. Everybody kind of knows about the water, but I think the personal stories and the losses, we're going to start to hear a lot more about that as the days unfold.
And what have you heard? Have your members told you about how they're trying to protect their animals?
Well, we have. I've talked to mail callers, been in touch kind of with our State Department. For the most part, we've been successfully moving milk pretty well. It's more the infrastructure is pretty tough right now. I've heard from the mail callers saying the average they're now driving about an extra 150 miles just to pick up or drive milk to the plants one way.
Is that because the roads are out?
Yeah, we're not as seriously impacted here in Antelope County as a lot of the states, but even here we have just heard yesterday 65% of our roads have damages, but 56% out of the 93 counties are drastically affected.
Can you talk about the timing of this flood? I mean, it's calving season. This is a very important time.
That's absolutely true. It's calving season for all our ranchers out here in this country, and it's actually, you know, we're called the beef state, but they're dealing with a lot. They've dealt with the stress of low prices, like all ag commodities, the last couple of years. Those that started calving a little bit earlier, they've been dealing with blizzards and snow and ice, and they're already looking pretty haggard from round-the-clock babysitting of those mama cows. Talked to a few people here just in the last couple days. A friend of mine, he calves about 1,500 cows, and, you know, everybody out here is pretty, tries to be pretty self-sufficient, and you don't hear a lot of complaining or bickering, but I know he told me personally he's already lost 40 calves in the last couple days, and it's not getting much easier.
Bill, if a rancher loses 40 calves, what does that mean for the operation?
Well, although that's way more than they would expect in that short a period of time, but it's huge. It's not like if a sun come out today and things are going to suddenly be better. I know another rancher that I don't have firsthand knowledge of it, but they're contracted to rural water, and last couple of days they've got about 5,000 head that they're trying to figure out how to get water to them, whether it's hauling them in or moving the cattle out. So it's real out here. It's the impact is going to be huge, and there's no doubt that there'll be a number of people that won't survive this in the state financially.
Well, by some estimates, the state's agriculture sector could face nearly $1 billion in losses from these floods. It also comes at a very, very difficult time for farmers who are dealing with trade tariffs, rising costs, bankruptcies. What are the long-term results of this disaster?
You know, a lot of people are going to have to make decisions, even if, you know, if the federal government will step in or some agency. Usually that means the best you can hope for is take out low-interest loans. But with the financial pressure that people have been in, I think a lot of people just decide they've had enough.
Give up.
They'll just give up. We've got farms totally wiped out, houses and all buildings and equipment that are gone. People that still can't get in or out of their places. We've got some small cities even that way as of today yet that, as far as I know, can't get in or out, no traffic. So Agriculture is really the backbone of Nebraska. As agriculture goes, so goes the state, and it's pretty darn tough.
I can hear it in your voice, Bill. You sound tired.
Well, again, there's a heck of a lot of people that are a lot worse off than us.
Bill Thiel, president of the Nebraska State Dairy Association, it's tough times there where you are. We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. I appreciate your call.
Humans haven't figured out yet how to move something at the speed of light. The closest we've ever gotten is in what's called a particle accelerator. The most powerful one today is in Europe. It's called the Large Hadron Collider. The previous record holder was in this country, in a prairie 35 miles west of Chicago, at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, or Fermilab. The accelerator was called the Tevatron, but in 2011 it was shut down. And Fermilab shifted its focus to a tiny particle that could help answer some of the biggest questions in physics, a particle called the neutrino.
Wolfgang Pauli said that they're almost impossible to detect. They are, but thankfully we've become very good at it.
That's Bonnie Fleming, Fermilab's deputy chief research officer. She says neutrinos have no electrical charge and almost no mass, but they're everywhere.
I know this is radio, but let's all hold out our hands and count to three. One, two, three. 3 trillion neutrinos just passed through my hand. So an enormous number of neutrinos from all sorts of different sources all over the universe. There are some left over from the Big Bang. They're produced in stars, in supernova, in nuclear reactors, in the highest cosmic accelerators in the universe, and in particle accelerators here on Earth.
And what difference do they make?
That's a good question, and that's one thing that we're trying to figure out. They're second in abundance only to the photon in the universe. So the fact that 3 trillion pass through your hand is really important, because even though they're very small, that's the eno part of neutrino, they are so abundant that they can affect the fabric of the cosmos. What they're going to tell us about the cosmos, we're still learning. That they have mass is something that we only learned on the order of 20 years ago. And that's a very fundamental property of any particle, in particular the building block elementary particles of the universe. And once we understood that, it opened up a host of new questions, in particular the one that Dune will answer, which is, do neutrinos act the same as antineutrinos and therefore can explain our matter-dominated universe? Put simply, are neutrinos the reason we exist?
DUNE stands for Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment. It has to be deep underground because when you're beaming particles across America, you don't want your detectors to get confused by cosmic rays at the surface. That's why to see another underground neutrino experiment at Fermilab called NOVA, we had to take an elevator into a subterranean tunnel.
So this is the main elevator here. We just press down, we'll start going down. It's a comfortable ride, but moves rather slowly. We only have to go 300 feet.
We left our IDs up top in case we get stuck so people will know where we are. And we had to get trained to use emergency breathing devices just in case. At the bottom, we find a cavernous tunnel with water trickling down the sides of rock walls. There are rows of computers and a semi-truck-sized box of acrylic bars filled with a special oil that measures the path of charged particles affected by the neutrinos passing through. From this tunnel, neutrinos are being beamed to a detector in Minnesota.
When will this experiment be done, or will it ever be done?
The NOVA experiment's been running for a number of years, since 2014. And has several more years of data taking. The DUNE experiment is under construction, and NOVA will finish running around the same time scale that DUNE will start up. And DUNE will run for decades.
Really?
Producing results along the way. First set of results after a certain number of years for the beam physics part of the experiment. Dune will also look for neutrino sources from all parts of the cosmos to learn about neutrinos and to learn about the cosmos, to look for neutrinos from supernova when stars explode, and what they can tell us again about the neutrinos and about supernova. And that, I think, will go on for a long time.
Would you say that this research is sort of in the same category as our space exploration?
You are looking into the farthest reaches of the universe through the eye of a neutrino interaction and the neutrinos that come from all of those different parts of the universe. And in that sense, absolutely, you're looking back in time and using the neutrinos to be able to do that.
Up we go.
One thing you can tell at Fermilab is that this kind of research doesn't come cheap. There are 4,000 scientists here, 1,000 working on Dune, which will use 70,000 tons of liquid argon. The detectors have to be kept at a temperature of minus 300 degrees Fahrenheit. The Dune project alone will cost around $1 billion in all. So why pay such a price for this research?
To first order, understanding what we're made of and where we came from. What we do in particle physics is break things down to the tiniest building blocks of matter, and we see this beautiful symmetries that are 12 building blocks of matter that make up all of what we see. So what's the main focus of the Dune experiment? Trying to understand if neutrinos can explain some asymmetry that happened in the early universe, which left us with a matter-dominated universe, which is why we exist. And fundamentally, that's a really fascinating and interesting question. It requires big experiments in big science to be able to answer, but knowing the answer to it tells us something about how the universe was created, how everything we see was created, and that's fantastic.
Scientists, engineers, and technicians are already working on the electronics, hardware, and computer programs for the gigantic particle detectors of Dune.
Their work creates... The head of Fermilab is a man named Nigel Lockyer. He's above ground in an office with a whiteboard full of complex mathematical equations. I asked him what questions Fermilab's researchers are answering. He said, why anything?
Yeah, why anything? Why anything exists? Where does it come from? As you start thinking about it, our world, your world that we see every day requires just two quarks, yet scientists have found six. And so what does that mean in terms of the original plan or how it plays out? Have we found all we need to find, or will be there'll be other things? I suspect we're scratching the surface on everything we know. We tend to think we're smart, but my favorite example is, can you teach quantum theory to a dog? And the dog would just look at you like, what are you talking about? We may be the dog in this case, but we think we know a fair amount.
Now, Fermilab used to be famous for the Tevatron, mm-hmm. which was a particle accelerator that closed in 2011. Mm-hmm. Was that because of budget reasons that it did that?
No. The Tevatron was the highest energy collider in the world mm-hmm. for about 25 years. It had taken over from CERN, who had had the previous highest
in
energy.
In Switzerland.
In Switzerland, the highest energy collider. And now the baton has been passed on to CERN again because they built yet another machine. And Fermilab has gone off in a new direction, which is the highest intensity beams.
But you've still got this big collider sitting right here on the campus, right?
It's sitting there underground, yeah, enjoying itself, I guess. But we think the science of the neutrino has a very clear direction to it with the technology we're using, the 70,000 tons of liquid argon. We should be able to observe whether that exploding star forms a neutron star or not. And we would also be able to see whether a black hole forms. And that would be real-time observation of that type of thing. So the experiment we're pursuing is not only understand the neutrino, but it's understand the role that the neutrino plays in the cosmos.
How difficult is it to explain to, let's say, the lawmakers that have to fund this place, mm-hmm. the importance of the work that you're doing here?
Well, there's usually two types of lawmakers. There's the lawmaker that loves science and wants to ask the same questions that we ask. And we have the appropriate conversation with them. And then there's the lawmakers who say, well, what good is this? What's it for? You know, how does it help society? So then I usually refer to a couple of accomplishments of the field. My first one I usually talk about is cancer therapy, which is something that we now modern hospitals or countries use protons, not just x-rays, for cancer therapy. And the seminal paper on using protons for cancer therapy was written by the first director of Fermilab in 1947. You mentioned the Tevatron. It was the first large superconducting accelerator in the world. We had to develop the superconductor itself in order to do that. Well, that same technology, same cable, let me say it that way, is used in every MRI in the world now. And so we've had an indirect, huge impact on medical physics. Fermilab built the first small accelerator to treat cancer that was put in a hospital in Loma Linda, California, many years ago, that was which is still treating thousands of patients per year. So it's, you know, we've done a number of things. It's not our main focus, but we have an impact nevertheless. And other parts of our field, as you know, perhaps CERN invented the World Wide Web. So I would have said, isn't that enough? But, you know, of course, everybody expects you to do something new. We're a laboratory that builds things, as you could probably see when you look at it. And we build things at the edge of what's possible.
Not far from Nigel Lockyer's office, there's a small herd of bison maintained by the lab since the 1960s to strengthen the lab's connection to its home in the prairie. Fermilab insists the bison don't glow in the dark, and they seem to be okay with the neutrinos, the trillions passing through them, me, and you as I speak. You can see photos from our trip to Fermilab at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Prime Minister of France says that potentially violent demonstrations will no longer be allowed on the Champs-Élysées in Paris after protesters clashed with police and damaged stores and restaurants there over the weekend. The yellow vest demonstrations have grown since they first began in November to protest a fuel tax increase. The government has made some concessions, but the protests continue. I spoke today with Bernard-Henri Lévy, a prominent French intellectual, about his new book. You can find that interview at hereandnow.org. But I also asked him about the protests and if he's surprised that they've gotten so violent.
I'm not surprised, but I am deeply shocked. I'm deeply scandalized by what is happening in my country. This movement of yellow vest has become, I'm sorry to say it, but just another fascist or crypto-fascist movement. The love for force, the hate of the republic, the refusal of the democratic rights and laws, the hate of the minorities, the anti-Semitism, and so on. All this is not a social movement. All this is politics, and it is the worst politics possible. And this is what the yellow vest have become.
And what would you suggest that President Macron do about it?
Exactly what he does. Now there are some places in Paris when the demonstrations of these movements are no longer authorized. We often say that they have no leaders, nobody to speak, and so on. That's untrue. There are some leaders, and they are truly undemocratic, unrepublican, uncivic leaders, and we know who they are, and we know exactly what they say, and they should be accountable for what they say.
What about their demands, though? The idea that there is a serious problem with income inequality in France, as there is in a lot of countries around the world.
Now, there is no demands. There is no demands. The yellow vests today have only one demand at this moment, which is to break, which is to take the risk of killing, and which is to topple the French president. No demands. At the beginning, there were some demands. And these demands, of course, they were just. Of course, they were fair. Any demand of new rights, any demand of a better share of the prosperity is justified. The question is to know if it is doable. The question is to know at what rhythm it is doable, at what speed. But no, no question. Of course, these demands were justified. But we are far from that. Now, the yellow jacket, don't call it a social movement. It is no longer a social movement. It's a political movement of the worst sort.
That is Bernard-Henri Lévy in Paris. We also spoke to him about his new book about America's role in the world. You can find that conversation at hereandnow.org.
You may remember the heartbreaking image from last summer of the orca who was pushing her dead calf around Puget Sound for 17 days. It brought new attention to the many threats facing the killer whales, known as the Southern Residents, who spend much of their lives near the San Juan Islands off the coast of Washington State. Recently, a task force commissioned by Washington's governor published recommendations about how to save these animals. Some had to do with reducing the noise of passing ships, because noise pollution levels can make the difference between an orca finding enough salmon to eat and starving. Eilish O'Neill of KUOW reports.
That's a recording of an endangered whale, an orca, making its way through the waters of Puget Sound.
Puget Sound seems sort of quiet. When you go down to the beach, you hear the waves like we're hearing here. It doesn't seem like it's a noisy place.
Scott Vares is an oceanographer who studies killer whale acoustics. I met him on a dock on Whidbey Island, where he was installing a hydrophone to listen to what it sounds like under the water. Vares says that quiet we hear from the dock, it's deceptive.
If you're tough and you swim out, get your ears near the bottom, you can hear ships go by. I did it recently at Edmonds. You could hear the ferry quite easily.
And it's not just ferries. It's also cargo ships, tankers, fishing boats, pleasure boats.
The ocean is a noisy place, particularly around here. Sound is transmitted much more efficiently underwater. For a typical ship going through Puget Sound, its sound is basically filling up this underwater canyon.
Like that cargo ship going by. In a recent study, Vares found that the biggest ships are the biggest culprits, contributing about half the noise in Puget Sound.
Sound is the sense that is most useful in the ocean. The water is typically pretty cloudy, so visual creatures like us don't do very well. The creatures who are at the top of the food chain, the local killer whales, are masters of sound.
So when whales can't hear, it's much worse than having a noisy neighbor.
The stakes are not sort of peace of mind or quality of life. It's truly life or death.
Rob Williams is a biologist who studied how orcas respond to noise. He says boat noise seems to disturb orcas more when they're eating than when they're traveling or socializing. And
if these whales are not finding food, they die.
In recent years, the ports of the Pacific Northwest have started looking at ways to solve the problem of vessel noise. It's a clear fall day, and a bright pink cargo ship is heading from the Port of Seattle to the open ocean. The pilot who navigated this ship through Puget Sound is climbing down a ladder onto a boat that will take him back to Port Angeles. He told me he left the ship's captain with some advice about how to stay away from orcas. Stay as far south in the shipping lane as possible. Eric von Brandenfels is the president of the Puget Sound Pilots.
You know, we show them the foraging area that lies, you know, along the southern coastline of Vancouver Island. And we explain that it will be helpful for them if they reduce speed and go along this traffic separation scheme.
There's no concrete incentive to go along with that, and yet about 90% of shipmasters who visit Puget Sound participate.
Mariners have, throughout history, they've always like had a love for marine mammals, and you know they have, because it's just always such a sight to see.
On the Canadian side of the border, the Port of Vancouver goes a step further and charges lower berthing fees to ships that slow down as they go through orca habitat. That program has cut Sound north of the border in half. Researcher Rob Williams is analyzing how the killer whales are responding.
This is a really hopeful environmental problem to work on. As soon as you remove the sound source, the problem goes away. If we can make it quieter, especially in the places that the whales are using to hunt, we can buy the whales some time while we take really bold and dramatic action to recover Chinook salmon stock.
William says possible solutions include slowing all ships down, recognizing shipping companies that take steps to quiet their vessels, and creating marine protected areas where ships can't go at all. The governor's task force recommended implementing a program similar to Vancouver's at Washington State's ports. It also suggested speeding up the transition of Washington State ferries to quieter vessels, and also banning commercial whale watching boats from watching southern residents. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Seattle.
And there's some political news today from a familiar name. Former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan has joined the board of Fox Corp, a new entity that includes Fox News. The move comes ahead of Disney's acquisition of much of the rest of 21st Century Fox, and while the network has dealt with controversy over hosts and critical presidential tweets. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. Hi, David.
Hey there.
So the Murdoch family has been dismantling Fox for months, but they are retaining Fox News under this new umbrella. What do you make of this news that Paul Ryan's joining that board?
Well, so the new Fox Corp consists basically of Fox News and Fox Business Network, the old line Fox Broadcast Network, and a bunch of Fox Sports properties, among a few other entities. For Paul Ryan to join is in keeping with the way in which Rupert Murdoch and his family has operated in over the years, where they've acquired essentially a lot of major political heavyweights to be on their corporate boards, occasionally as top executives, essentially as a hedge. They're in a fairly heavily regulated business. Particularly when you think about acquisition of cable and other properties. And also they get into a lot of controversy. So think of some of the people they've had on their boards over the years, people like the prime minister, the ex-prime minister of Spain, people like former Senator Kelly Ayotte. You have people, assistant attorneys general like over on News Corp. Joel Klein was there under Bill Clinton. Viet Dinh was an assistant attorney general under George W. Bush. And those two were incredibly important to help guide the company through the scandals associated with the tabloid hacking controversy scandals, criminal charges that you saw over in Britain. And they were really fearful of facing federal Foreign Corrupt Practices Act charges here in the States. They were able to avoid that, and those ties they had to those kinds of figures really helped.
Will he have any impact on the content on the air?
I think it's very unlikely. I think he probably really rues the fact, Paul Ryan, that he didn't have much influence over the content when he was Speaker. One of the things that made his life complicated was how much the Fox's most popular shows would push the Republican Party farther and farther to the right, making it very difficult for then-Speaker Paul Ryan to corral his conference into a cohesive whole.
So that's behind the scenes. Meanwhile, in front of the camera, former interim DNC chair Donna Brazile is joining the network as a commentator. And here she is talking about that decision.
I've been on and off Fox for the last 15 years, but this is an opportunity to reach across the aisle, to reach even within my own political party and to independents and others who might want to hear what's happening within the Democratic Party, what's happening in the country, and of course, hear my perspective.
Now, Brazile is a big name in the Democratic Party. They are really no fan of Fox News. How do you think her colleagues will be taking this?
Right. Well, the DNC, for example, said that Fox News would not be hosting any of its debates in the upcoming primary season, in part because of they cited a New Yorker piece exposing unfairness, but really is a deep grained grievances against the way in which Fox News have treated Democratic candidates and the party, particularly Hillary Clinton, if you think back to 2016. And they just don't trust even their journalists to give them a fully fair shake. You know, Fox always points that split between news and opinion. What Donna Brazile will bring is a Democratic perspective. But let's not forget that Brazile herself is somewhat compromised. She remained a major Democratic Party official and superdelegate when she was at CNN and, as it turned out, had fed questions to the Clinton campaign that she knew might be posed during ahead of a CNN town hall.
Right.
She remains a major player in Democratic Party circles. She will be – it's not clear to whom her allegiances lie. Fox News and the Murdochs, to the audience and the their understanding of politics, or to the Democrats with whom she, you know, essentially is operating when she's not on the studios of Fox News.
All of this is happening while Fox is dealing with another issue: the president going after the network for suspending Jeanine Pirro, who made allegedly Islamophobic statements about Representative Ilhan Omar recently, and the controversy over host Tucker Carlson and his misogynistic and racist comments from the past. Question for you, David. Why wasn't Tucker Carlson suspended as well?
Well, and let's be clear, Fox News won't confirm that Jeanine Pirro was suspended. They seem to want the benefit of having her off the air and signaling to advertisers and to viewers who care that she has been suspended, but won't say so publicly, very much because their red meat base viewer is very much the kind of viewer that the president himself represents, and they don't want to get any more approbation than – or excuse me, any more antagonism than they're already receiving. The president is trying to push them back into sort of the make America great again corner. Yep. Fox News has prospered there. It wants credibility on the outside. Tough to thread that needle.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.
Scientists are reporting that a giant meteor exploded in the Earth's atmosphere on December 18th. How did we miss it? Well, the fireball, that's the NASA term for this type of event, exploded 16 miles above the Bering Sea between Russia and Alaska. What's the joke? If a meteor falls in the Bering Sea and no one's around to hear it? Anyway, NASA reports it was the second most powerful fireball to enter the atmosphere in 30 years, and NASA says there have been 5 notable fireball events so far this year. In fact, last night, the American Meteor Society says several dozen people reported seeing a fireball over the northeast United States around 10:35 p.m. Eastern Time. People from Washington, D.C. up to Maine reported sighting that meteor. Well, down here on Earth, it's been more than 50 years since its Broadway debut, but Fiddler on the Roof remains one of the most widely performed musicals in the United States, and a new version performed entirely in Yiddish was a surprise hit over the summer in New York. Now it's been moved to the largest off-Broadway theater in the city. John Kalish reports.
29-year-old Michal Yashinsky was a scholar at the National Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts, when he heard about the Yiddish production of Fiddler. He'd done some acting in college, decided to audition, and won 2 parts. He says the company feels like a shtetl, Yiddish for a small village.
We enter all holding hands as a company, and then we hear the bum, 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 bum of the opening number, and it just goes right to your heart, right to your kishkis.
Yashinsky is one of the few cast members who's fluent in Yiddish. This guy certainly isn't.
I'm the director.
The director.
That's me.
That's Joel Grey, best known as the Oscar and Tony-winning MC of Cabaret. He was offered the lead role of Tevye, but decided to direct instead. Grey says that not speaking Yiddish meant he and his actors worked on the scenes in English first.
On and on and on until they were clear about the ideas and the feelings and the truth of the matter. And I had, you know, a half a cast that was not even Jewish that were walking with me on the English stage. We had to know what we felt, especially the non-Jewish cast members. They needed to have it grounded and understood in their bones.
Verbrochen und Herzlochen, verleben und gesund sein, in a guter und maseldicher Schau, soll sein mit Glück lachaim. L'chaim, l'chaim, soll sein.
The story climaxes in the expulsion of Jews from a shtetl in Tsarist Russia. It was based on the short stories of the great Yiddish author Sholem Aleichem, who witnessed pogroms in his native Russia before coming to America in 1906. So it's important for audiences to hear the musical in Yiddish, says Zalman Mlutik, the artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater, or Volksbühne, which is behind the Fiddler reboot.
The audience is, by hearing it in Yiddish, they're transported on some level to that time, because when Sholem Aleichem wrote these stories, he wrote them in Yiddish because that's what they were speaking.
Jente vol kein Eretz Yisrael.
Jackie Hoffman is one of a number of Broadway veterans in the show, from costume and set designers to actors. She plays Yenta the matchmaker and says the beloved musical seems to have had its DNA rearranged for the Yiddish production.
What's fascinating to me is that it's almost as if it's a different animal. The English version sounds almost vulgar to me now. This seems like an entirely different show.
Yiddish Fiddler's initial run ended in December, but it was so popular that two Broadway producers found a much larger house.
It's historic for the Yiddish theater.
The Volksbühne's Zalman Mlutik.
These Broadway producers believe that there is an audience, and for the Yiddish theater, that hasn't happened. I can't point to a production that started in the Yiddish theater and then moved uptown.
And it's important for the language and Yiddish culture, says Michal Yashinsky. He had to leave the original production to take a job teaching Yiddish at the University of Michigan. Now the school has given him a leave of absence to rejoin the company for the new run.
I'm helping to add more links to this golden akate, as you say in Yiddish, a golden chain of culture that's inherited from one generation to the next. And it's upon us all to just keep adding links to that chain, not to lose grasp of it.
Yashinsky may be faced with another tough choice between going back to his teaching job or continuing with the show. Discussions are underway to take the musical to Los Angeles, Chicago, London, and beyond. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Ganze Tag wollte ich sich für die Bum, wenn ich bin ein reicher Mann.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Eufke beut a hois wie a palatz daf ken mitten von der Stadt. A schönem Dach und a keumen was bloß da reicht.